We are first going to do the work session on House Bill 2880, very briefly, and then we are going to move on. Our first hearing will be Senate Bill 597, and then we will go to the top of the page and go through the hearings as listed. I'm going to open the work session 2880. We have Judge Legert here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Terry Legert, for the record, I am in the middle of a jury trial, and I apologize appreciate you letting me go first. This issue just came up it's a request to have stalking orders be done in the courts instead of being served by police officers and taking out the provision that allows police officers to do citations for stalking orders. And the issue, part of the issue that came up was the cost that it would be for the courts to do these, like we do FAPA orders, which are the restraining orders. There is a fiscal that's been done, and Kingsley Click, who's up here with me, is more conversant in that. But I just wanted to bring some issues to the committee's attention that I think need to be addressed, and I really want to suggest that these issues go to an interim committee to study what's happening with stalking orders and FAPA orders. And a couple of things I just real quickly wanted to draw to your attention, and one is, in my county, the police officers do the screening. They go, the victim comes to them, talks to them, victim I should say, petitioner, and asks for a restraining order. They spend about an hour, SPD, at a Salem police I talked to, and I said, how do you do these right now? And we had about 90 last year. They talk to the person for about an hour, then they listen to what they have to say. If they think they're asking for the wrong thing, they then suggest that maybe they need to FAPA a restraining order, or maybe there's some, actually, from what they tell them, there's some criminal action by the person that needs to be investigated. Anyway, they go then find the person, they give the person the citation, then we have, I think it's 48 hours from the time it's served to have a hearing, and we do that. But what they do in that process is they do a screening function. If you put that function in the court, and our staff would be doing, to some extent, that same screening function, except they don't have the same powers that the police do to actually go look for the person and talk to the respondent as well. But in any event. And I think that's working well, at least in my county. Now, I know in some counties they're using the civil procedure, which allows the person to just come to the courts and do it themselves. And the numbers that have happened in terms of increase in stalking orders that have been filed is significant. Just to compare, Lane County had 74 in 1997 stalkings. We had 76. They started having the civil process be used there, and they went from 74 in 97 to 295 in the year 2000. Ours went from 76 to 90 in the same time frame. The second thing that happened that I was concerned about, if this gets switched out of the police function into the courts function, is that the service of all of these stalking orders then go to the sheriff's office. So I contacted our sheriff yesterday and said, how long does it take you to serve a FAPA, which is a similar procedure? They said it takes a minimum of 4 man hours for them to do that. Right now, the service, because of the way it's done in the police agencies, is spread among the police agencies. It's a big issue for them. They contacted their lobbyist organization. They were totally unaware of this proposal, and are real concerned about the cost that's going to be the county sheriffs. The other thing about it is people have been talking about, well, you really don't need staff to help them fill it out. I see two problems if you're not having staff actually spending time explaining to them the forms and looking over the forms and making sure that it's right. One problem is people are going to fill it out wrong, and somebody that actually needs a stalking order isn't going to get one because they're not going to know what to put down there. They're not going to fill it out correctly. The second issue, if it's incomplete, is the flip side of that, is that we're going to issue stalking orders on cases where they shouldn't be issued, and they have some very serious consequences to people. I'm going to give you two quick examples of ones recently in my court. They're not just being used in the situations that I think we all anticipate stalking to be. Stalking, I think most of us think about somebody obsessed, mentally ill, you know, leaving roses in somebody's house, maybe a coworker that thinks the person's in love with them but they have some mental problem. We had one case 2 weeks ago, a 13-year-old girl's parents were filing one against her 13-year-old classmate because he was calling her names at school. Now, Judge Ochoa deferred that, didn't have a hearing, and referred them to some other people. But if that was issued, where's that 13-year-old respondent going to be going to school, you know, if there's a temporary order issued? And what I just had was an 18-year-old getting one against a 23-year-old boy who was threatening him over a girl. So the stalking statute, I'm concerned about how it's been expanded in any event. The next just quick issue, I know you're busy, is we have Family Abuse Prevention Act orders. Apparently a lot of people that get those are also trying to get a stalking at the same time. And if they're trying to get them for reasons that the FAPA statute is not, has a problem with it, I think we should address that. That's a public policy question that I would really suggest an interim committee could talk about. I don't believe that the stalking statute should just be used routinely for every single FAPA. In our county, we had over 1,000 FAPAs last year and 90 stalkings. I think the stalking statute's more directed and should be more directed. We've expanded the FAPA statute for lots of good reasons, but it includes things like siblings can get them, roommates can get them. So to the extent that we expand the FAPA to do the stalking, for every FAPA we have a stalking, that's a problem. And really the last problem that I'm concerned about where we have FAPAs and stalkings is that we have expedited hearings on FAPAs, expedited hearings on stalkings. They're required to be done relatively quickly. My experience with these hearings is when you have the hearing, expedited hearing, it can last anywhere from an hour to half of a day. Our dockets are just jammed up with these front-end procedures. So if people are trying to get both, maybe we need to talk in interim about how we can combine these things. The sheriff's having to serve both of them. We're supposed to have hearings on both of them, and it's creating some huge problems. So anyway, but most of these people, by the way, are getting both the FAPAs and the stalking orders are pro se, and that really expands, you know, the time that's involved with the courts looking at them in terms of, you know, the form, filling the forms out, and the hearings themselves. People show up 15 or 20 witnesses. Maybe half of them are irrelevant and wouldn't be called if there was an attorney involved, but they're pro se, they don't know, they have a bunch of people there. In fact, the last hearing I had, when I just spoke about with the 18 and 20-year-old, there were 15 witnesses and it took most of an afternoon. So those are all my concerns, and I just suggest that this be considered more closely with all of the partners that are going to be affected by it, the sheriffs, the police agencies, our agency, the domestic violence community, the people that are concerned in stalking, the mental health community. I think a lot of the mental health community is involved in the stalking arena. We refer a lot of those stalking respondents to mental health organizations to get help dealing with them. So those were my quick comments.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Anything you wish to add?
For the record, Kingsley Cliff, State Court Administrator. Yes, I think Judge Layard went through some of the major kind of reality issues that we're facing with this, and why we have had resource concerns, and we're very willing to work during the interim, because I think there's issues with FAPA and with stalking that, because of what's been happening in the last several years with the kind of the dual tracks for these, and I think there's a lot that needs to be cleaned up with them and can be to make it a much more streamlined process and a safer process for the people that are trying to use it. And I think doing it in a little more time frame way, because we weren't involved in the interim with any of the discussion groups on these bills. So that would be very helpful to us, and we really would like to do that.
So. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Belissa Seidlick, Family Law Senior Policy Analyst with the Oregon Judicial Department, and I have nothing further to add. Be happy to respond to questions. Okay. Anyone have any questions of this panel?
I guess I do. Kingsley, are you? Yeah, I know you got a copy of the memo that David Niebel passed out to the members of the committee. And it includes an email from a practitioner who kind of goes through some of the numbers that are the basis of your fiscal impact, or are part of the basis of your fiscal impact. And some of the points that this person makes is that that the court is already providing the forms in Linn County, and Clackamas, Multnomah, and Lane counties are already providing the forms. I would think those would be big, big impact counties in terms of the forms already being provided. And I'm wondering if it's working in those counties, why it can't work in the rest of the state.
Chair Walker, committee council, I'm going to defer to Melissa, who did talk to those counties about that, because we too said this seems a little different than what the judges had written in. So.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Chartel, I did speak to two of the judges in Lynn and Benton County, as well as their trial court administrators, to find out what the process is. I want to point out before I go into those counties that in those counties where forms are being distributed, that is kind of where we discovered there is an effect by providing forms. Looking at the numbers, in Clackamas County, once forms became available through victims' assistance, they jumped fivefold from 24 to 140. And Judge Leggard pointed out the numbers in Lane County. When I spoke to the trial court administrators and the judges, I found out that I think those counties represent a unique situation where the courts have worked with their domestic violence community, with legal aid, with the district attorneys, and they established a process whereby forms would be available either at the court counter or at the district attorneys. And in Benton County, anyway, it was agreed that the district attorneys and the women's shelter and legal aid would provide assistance to individuals filling these out. What eventually evolved was that the district attorney and the women's shelter declined to do so any further because of lack of resources and a concern that they were providing legal advice. In Lynn County, I spoke with Judge Murphy, who is very active in this process. In fact, he designed the forms for stalking. And he expressed to me great concern about having statewide forms because each judicial district has a different population and different feelings about what the form should look like and how the procedure should take place. For example, he feels strongly about having an ex parte hearing up front before issuing a temporary order, and there are a couple of courts that will issue a temporary order based solely on the filing of the papers, and those papers are typically they have been filled out with the assistance of a facilitator or someone, so they've been gone through and assured of correctness or completeness. I think that is all that I can report on my conversations with those courts.
Mm-hmm. Could I just add something, Madam Chair? Chair Leggard, again, for the record. Just to add what Melissa had just said, these forms are being filled out with the help of somebody. You know, they're not just being put in a lobby and say, you figure it out. And that's what we found out. We look behind the numbers, and they're increasing dramatically. Lynn County is a relatively small county. They had small numbers to begin with. If we have to have a hearing in every single case, which I would want to because of the serious consequences on stalking, because it can keep people from doing their jobs, depending on what their job is, the fiscal doesn't even talk about the impact on the courts. So you want somebody talking to them ahead of time to make sure that they're given the right thing, it's for the right purpose, and then I don't have to have a hearing to get to the end and find out, no, it's not appropriate. We just don't have a staff to do that. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me go first.
David Nebel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm David Nebel with the Oregon Law Center. I'm worked with the folks who put this bill together, and I would say a couple of things. One is we're not doing anything that would limit or impair the police officer route to getting a stalking order whatsoever. That is left completely intact by this bill. Our intent in this bill was to make the remedy that exists now more available to people who need it. We didn't change the substantive law of stalking at all in this bill. That was our intent. There were questions that came up during the public hearing that about, you know, what the status of the current law was, but that is in current law. I think perhaps it is a good idea to have a group to get together in the interim to look at some of these issues that the committee has raised, and that in fact the Judicial Department itself raised when we floated this idea by them early in the session. They raised a bunch of issues about current law. I am worried that if we do nothing, however, now on this issue, I'm worried that next session we're going to get to a point where, at this point in the session, and we're looking at a bill that has the same kind of fiscal impact that the Judicial Department would not have budgeted for. And we'd be confronted with the same kind of problem. So one option that I think that the committee might consider would be passing this bill out, but making the effective date for having the forms being available at courthouses, say July 4th, 2003. So it would be in the next biennium, so it would be a chance for the courts to actually budget for this fiscal impact. It seems to me that the courts could, in the interim, develop the form to use, and I think that would not have a large fiscal impact. I don't have the firsthand knowledge to really talk about what the fiscal impacts on the courts are. I provided the information that I had from my colleague in Linn County who practices in Albany, in the Albany Legal Aid Office. And that's the best information I have about what the fiscal impact would be. I would say that in the counties that the Judicial Department cited, that whose numbers have gone up since forms have been available, my expectation would be that those counties probably wouldn't see vast increases in the numbers of stalking orders or stalking petitions that were filed because the forms are already available. I think you might see a fairly large increase in Washington County, which has a very low caseload now, probably inappropriately low caseload now, because the orders aren't available or the forms aren't available. I think if forms were available in Washington County, that they would probably see an increase. And I'll just that's all I really have to say. I think that I would urge the committee to discuss or to think about making the effective date of the statute July 1st, 2003, or the bill July 1st, 2003. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee
has. Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Nagel? Thank you very much. Okay. I understand the necessity of making these kinds of options regarding stocking available to those who need them, but I think that some of the issues raised today need to be resolved on an interim committee. So I'm going to close the work session right now, and we'll move to our next bill. Thank you very much. Okay. I do need to announce that the floor session is at 10 o'clock this morning. So those of you that are going to testify, if you have written testimony, attorney, please summarize your testimony so we can try to get through so everyone that has come here today for their hearings will be able to get through the entire agenda. Senate Bill 597. Senate Bill 597. Daryl Fuller and Daniel Fuller. Is Is this Fuller and Sons lobbying group here?
Good morning. My name is Daryl Fuller, and I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. You want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Daniel, and I'm 5 and a half.
We've been talking about leaders and lobbyists and lawyers and decision makers, and so I thought it would be nice if Daniel came this morning. Daniel, can you tell these people what Danny does when he goes to work?
He plays golf.
We'll work on that one.
If he thinks we're going to be easy on him.
I did get to the head of the agenda. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 597 is a code word for what I consider consent calendar. It's an issue with no objection, and is very. We've worked on it a little bit last session and finish it up this session. Oregon law was silent when it comes to whose insurance is responsible for paying for damage when somebody is using a vehicle that's not their own. Most insurance policies have other vehicle coverage that covers rental cars, but because statute wasn't clear, we had a case where insurance companies were competing over who ought to pay, and they were spending more money in attorney's fees than they were actually paying out for damage to vehicles. So we passed a law 2 years ago that made it clear in statute that when a consumer is renting a vehicle, whether it be from a rental agency or from a dealer, that the driver's insurance was primary and that the dealer's insurance or the rental agency's insurance was excess. The excess was left there in case the driver didn't have insurance. The last part of that is the cases where a driver is test driving a vehicle and gets into an accident. Again, the statute doesn't specify, so you have insurance companies that are arguing over who ought to be responsible. And so I've talked to all of the insurance lobby, and they understand that what we need to do is make it clear in statute. And based on the theory that people who are driving a vehicle get into the accident, the vehicle doesn't get into an accident by itself, we've determined that the driver's insurance ought to be primary. You have to make it clear at the beginning of the test drive that the driver's insurance is primary. They have to sign an agreement acknowledging that their insurance would be primary, and this would only be effective if they had insurance that covered other vehicle driving. If the dealer doesn't have them sign an agreement, or if the consumer doesn't have insurance that covers other vehicles, then the insurance of the dealer would be considered primary in that case. Bill came over from the Senate without opposition, has no opposition that I'm aware of. Would appreciate your support.
Thank you. Any further comment?
Could I ask a question?
You may.
No, I got it through. I'm okay.
Any other questions?
That is probably the cutest 5-and-a-half-year-old that we've ever seen in this
community. Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, I would tend to agree. My daughter will be here.
At least since my children were 5 and a half.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else who wish to testify on this bill? Okay. I'm going to close the hearing and open the work session on House Bill 597. Any discussion?
I was going to make a motion.
Mm-hmm. I would entertain a motion.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 597 with a due-pass recommendation to the full committee.
Thank you. Representative Backlund moves Senate Bill 597 to the full committee with a due-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none. Roll call, please, Ann.
Aye.
Representative Wells?
Aye.
Representative Engel?
Aye.
Representative
Cleverly? Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. Senate Bill 597 passes to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Do I have a carrier? Volunteer.
Volunteer?
Thank you. Okay. I'm going to open the hearing on House Bill 3670. Council, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3670 comes to us from Representative Williams, and it grants civil immunity to county clerks and their employees when administering official duties.
Thank you. Al Davidson.
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Al Davidson, Marion County Clerk, representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. I would have brought my 3-year-old granddaughter, but I have a picture if anybody's interested.
Good technique.
The testimony that's being handed out to you was prepared by Clackamas County Clerk John Kaufman, who was expected to be here to testify this morning. He had a conflict, so I'm substituting for him. I will not read his testimony. I'll just summarize. This bill extends to the county recording officers the same civil immunity protections that now are offered to the state recording officer, the Secretary of State, in his or her acceptance of UCC filings. The county clerks record hundreds of thousands of documents every year. And currently we have, in our statute, limited immunity for accepting a document erroneously. But what we don't have is any immunity, civil immunity, for rejecting a document. And let me explain to you why I think that's important. The new wave of terrorism in this country is called paper terrorism, and it's mainly practiced against public officials. There are organizations out there that are becoming more and more prevalent that seek to, through the recording process, damage public officials by filing liens and those sorts of things against public officials. In our county, we had a lien filed against the governor for $100 million, and several judges have had those kinds of things filed against them. And while we do have statutes, we've worked with the legislature, and you've wisely adopted things that make those kinds of things illegal. When we reject those documents, we are still liable to be sued for rejecting those documents. And whereas the Secretary of State's office has an immunity that does not leave them liable. So what we see happening in other parts of the country, it hasn't become prevalent here, although we have some of the same organizations here doing the same kinds of things, is that the recording officers will reject those documents and they will immediately be sued. And while the suits are winnable because of the way the laws are written, making those kinds of actions illegal, it still takes the resources of the county to fight a civil suit like that. We think that that is an important protection that would be extended to the counties that now belongs to the state. It's a very simple provision, and I would be happy to answer any questions. I urge your approval in sending this on to the full committee.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Davidson?
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I just want to slow this down for a second. It says except as provided in 4 is 3260 to 3300. No, I see what those are. If you know,
I can't enlighten you on that. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
That would be the Tort Claims Act.
It's my understanding we're still liable for, as all public officials are, for suits against us for the misperformance of our duty or malfeasance sort of thing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jack Monroe.
Thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe speaking today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. Clerk Davidson and I are in the same position. We're last-minute stand-ins. A couple of words by way of background before I get to the bill. There has been for some time an ongoing disagreement between some county clerks and members of the real estate and land use section of the bar and the title industry over filing issues. Some counties have gone to a rather strict list of documents from which they won't deviate, meaning if the title isn't correct on the document, they won't file it. Now, I don't need to go any further because happily it appears that we are well on our way to resolving that issue in a separate policy discussion that's going on in the context of House Bill 3673, which is before the Rules Committee. But the issues that I would raise in the context of this bill are as follows. As Mr. Davidson indicated, this is apparently patterned on ORS 798010, which provides that the Secretary of State and officers of that office shall not be liable to debtors, et cetera, for UCC filing-related errors. Now, as I would read it, shall not be liable is effectively a shield for the party from exposure to monetary damages. You'll notice, and I guess the question I'm raising, that the language here is are immune from civil liability. And I think the question is that some sort of a qualified immunity? Is it an absolute immunity? Would it, for example, preclude a mandamus action to essentially, you know what that process is, go to court and force an action, such as a filing? So I think that's the technical issue that's there. The policy issue, obviously, is, as Clerk Davidson has indicated, there are immunities in the statute in at least two places in Chapter 205 for essentially shielding somebody from doing it badly. You know, right now, clearly, there is no immunity or apparently no immunity for not doing it at all or not recording something that, in fact, should have been recorded. And so, you know, I guess the policy question is it appropriate to provide an immunity in that kind of situation? I certainly recognize, and we recognize the problem that that Clerk Davidson has raised, the posse comitatus style encumbrance liens that they filed. But as he also quite correctly pointed out, you, in your wisdom, a couple of sessions ago in 205-450 and the succeeding sections provided or attempted to provide a mechanism there for allowing clerks to refuse to file those types of encumbrances, and you provided actual damages or $5,000 civil penalty provisions to provide recompense if that sort of filing occurred. So, you know, I think the real question I'd ask is, what do you mean when you say immune from civil liability? And if you're talking about precluding the possibility of a mandamus action, I think there will be people out there that will be quite concerned about not having had that option.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Monroe? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here that wants to testify on House Bill 3670? Okay, I am going to close the hearing on 3670, and we are going to move on to the next one. We want to get this done by 10 o'clock, far as that. Senate Bill 118, open the work session, the hearing on Senate Bill 118.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 118, rather than go through all of the things that it does, I will tell you that it is a combination of four different Senate bills that were filed through the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee at the request of the Oregon State Bar. And I'd also let you know that in your packets and also handed out to you, I believe you have a copy of some amendments that are really just technical word changes type of things. In my looking them over, I didn't see any substantive changes in those.
Okay, thank you. Andrew Morrow, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Morrow. I'm an attorney with Foster, Pepper, and Scheffelman LLP in Portland, and I'm here in my capacity as the legislative chair of the business law section of the Oregon State Bar. As counsel described, this bill has a combination of a number of other bills, so it has various elements to it. I will. The written testimony goes through an explanation of each of those elements. I'll cover them very briefly. There's also a section-by-section description of the bill at the back. There are basically actually five elements in here because one of the bills had two parts to it. The first one has to do with some issues of bank fraud. That's sections 39 to 47 of the bill. Basically, the Secretary of State and the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities have discovered that because Oregon corporate law does not prohibit corporations from filing whatever name basically they want to do, as long as it doesn't conflict with other names, that there have been people filing articles of incorporation for institutions they are calling banks, when in fact they have no authority to do banking business. These corporations have then been used for fraudulent activities, some of them even in Eastern Europe, where people have been persuaded to either buy these corporations thinking they had an American bank charter, or depositing money with something that they thought was an American bank, in fact is not. In order to deal with that situation, there are basically two parts to the solution here. The first part is a prohibition on filing articles of incorporation or other kinds of business registry documents that have the words bank and a series of other words that relate to financial institutions without first getting clearance from the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, technically the director of the Department of Consumer Business Services. There's an exception so that the Secretary of State could go ahead with a filing that obviously doesn't relate to banking, a blood bank, those kinds of things. And there is a procedure in the bill for the division to process a request for a certificate to clear this information and some ability to investigate if there is a need to do that. Secondly, we're tightening, the bill would tighten up the provisions that prohibit organizing a corporation under Oregon law to do banking or savings and loan business without being organized under the statutes for that purpose in the Bank Act or in the Savings Association legislation. And again, an ability to investigate and potentially bring cease and desist process, disgorgement, and those kinds of remedies in the event one of these violations is discovered. Finally, there's an ability to issue an order by the director identifying the fact that a business entity is unlawfully doing banking or savings association business, and the Secretary of State could then revoke essentially the certificate or articles of incorporation of that entity. Second part of the bill relates to closely held corporations, and Professor Robert Art is going to explain that part of the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Art. I'm a professor of law at Willamette University and served as chair of a task force of the business law section of the state bar on closely held corporations and shareholder rights. This addresses an issue that was raised in the last legislative session regarding the plight of small shareholders in corporations whose shares are not publicly traded, the great bulk of corporations in this state. They're in a difficult situation in that if they are mistreated, they are subjected to fraud or illegality or oppression by the those in control of the corporation. They don't have the ability to dissolve as they would if they were partners. They don't have the ability to sell their shares as they would if they were in a larger publicly traded corporation. What this bill does is specify and clarify the remedies that are available to them, primarily buyout of their shares by the other shareholders or the corporation. And it provides a means for early termination of that litigation by a buyout at a price that's either agreed or specified by the court. There's much more detail about this if you're interested, but it's specified in the written materials, and I'll just be available for questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Ringo.
I'd just ask the questions to go along. Aren't the laws relating to closely held corporations based on model?
Yes, it is. And we were careful to make this consistent with the Model Business Corporation Act, which is the basis of Oregon's Corporation Act and the acts of most of the states.
But currently, the Oregon statute doesn't have these provisions that you are seeking to add, and those provisions exist in the Model Corporation Act.
Currently, the Oregon Act provides only one remedy, which is dissolution by judicial order of the corporation. That's typically the worst remedy available, both for the plaintiff and for the corporation and for the economy. Courts virtually never provide that remedy.